From WHQR Public Media in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Cabbage casserole. Does it conjure images of comfort food and yummy smells? Or does it remind you of the cringeworthy dish from Aunt Gertrude that made the house smell like Uncle Leo's indigestion? Are you bored with the way you've prepared the turkey to the point where you look forward more to the side dishes than the meal's centerpiece? Have you tried to cook it other ways and suffered through exploding oil or a bird burnt to a hard crisp? It's our annual holiday food show where you get to ask the experts how to deal with a particular food conundrum you've encountered in years past and not solved. But even better, if you're looking for some really good ideas that are new, but won't alienate those who love tradition. Today is your day. Do you avoid tackling pies because you're just not sure about the crust? With us to answer your food questions, culinary royalty, executive chef and co-owner of Pinpoint Restaurant in downtown Wilmington on Market Street between Front and Second, our local legend, Dean Neff. Welcome back to Coastline.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you here. And this year we have a special treat. Lydia Clopton is the pastry chef at Pinpoint. She is also the owner of the recently opened bakery, Love Lydia. And she is here to answer all of your baking questions. Lydia Clopton, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you here. And now we're inviting you to join the conversation and ask your holiday food question. We're opening the phone lines a little early on this Wednesday. You can call us now at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. Before we get into the holiday food stuff, I want to recognize that the fact that we're able to have this conversation and that a lot of our listeners are looking for ideas and solving food problems speaks to the level of privilege and abundance that we all enjoy. And there are a lot of people who are in this region who don't enjoy that level of privilege. And Dean Neff, you participate in a program called the Welcome Table. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so Welcome Table was actually started in Asheville, North Carolina, and we participated in that event when we were living there about 4 or 5 years ago. And it started off kind of as a gathering for anyone to show up and have lunch. And restaurants kind of got involved and chefs started sort of preparing foods and making it known and actually raising money within their restaurants to sort of cover the cost of food. And also in doing that, we're really encouraging their guests to attend this lunch, to bring people together from all different backgrounds just to sit down for 40 minutes and eat. And so we're actually doing that here in Wilmington now. A pastor by the name of Philip Christ, who's kind of got on board with this a couple weeks before I started thinking about it, and we ended up getting put in touch with each other, and I think we've participated in about three of these already, and they happen actually every Thursday at Grace United Methodist Church on 4th Street downtown, and what we're doing is we're trying to sort of pass the buck along to different restaurants to be involved and do these dinners. Or these lunches, rather, you know, once a month. And our next one is February. We're in the process of sort of challenging some of our some restaurants in our area to partake as well, so that there's one restaurant involved every month.
And the idea is that people of any socioeconomic background, more affluent or people who don't have much of anything, can go and sit together, and there's never a check that's going to come.
Exactly. It's the name says it all, Welcome Table. They're welcoming everyone together. And, you know, I think one of the things that we really want to get across to people who support it in our restaurants, Lydia actually also, she raised money for the last one that we did and did the dessert. But we want people to know that they're welcome as well. It's not that you're donating money and, you know, you think of it as buying yourself lunch. And so you're putting 5, 20, whatever amount of money you're putting in there, and then you're showing up and having lunch.
That's great. Lydia Clopton, pastry chef and owner of Love Lydia. Before we get into the ins and outs, I mean, you are probably a cross between a scientist and an artist when it comes
sure.
to dealing with baking, which could be so stressful for a lot of people. But
you have some advice, just some overarching, this is the way to think about the day before we really get into it.
Yeah, I think you shouldn't stress too much about cooking on that day and stress about making something for the first time. If you're wanting to take on a challenge, I suggest that you do it ahead of time and not do it on the day of Thanksgiving so you can spend more time with your loved ones.
That's really good advice. I also want to address the recent news about the recall of romaine lettuce. What is that going to do to our Thanksgiving plans? I'm not sure that there have been any cases of illness reported in North Carolina, but the CDC is saying across the board, even if you've already opened the package and eaten from it, don't eat any more romaine lettuce. What does that mean for your restaurant, Dean Neff?
It means nothing, actually, for our restaurant.
Okay.
But and for Thanksgiving, we haven't planned any romaine menu items. And, you know, all of our lettuces are generally coming from local people right now. And stay away from the romaine. No Caesar salads.
Fair enough. Okay, so we're not talking about romaine. Just throw that out. Get rid of it. So let's start with oyster casserole, because Gus is asking about that. He says it's one of those dishes that could easily go wrong. How would Dean and Lydia tackle this southern side?
Well, I would first use Lydia's bread. I think that would be a good starting point.
And that would be my only contribution.
Other than that, I think, it's something that, you know, typically when we make, this is kind of a creamy pie, typically from my encounters with oyster pie. And typically what we do is, instead of making a bechamel, which is one of the mother sauces, we try to kind of make something a little bit different that doesn't have gluten. It's not a milk-based sauce. We actually use a little bit of heavy cream, and we use the white parts of leeks, which are a variety of onion, mince those up and steep them in cream and puree that and use that sort of in place of a bechamel. I kind of prefer that because it adds, I love leeks in dishes like this. It adds a lot of comforting kind of flavor notes. And something else that's nice in there as well is a little celery root when working with oysters. You could do that. And so what we're doing is we're creating this sort of cream sauce, and then we're using kind of a little bit of an oyster stock, almost like a stuffing, to sort of resaturate bread. Typically you don't want to overcook oysters. That's kind of like the thing that happens most oftentimes when, you know, great oysters go bad. And you want to make sure that you're kind of maybe finishing with some oysters as well so that they're not overcooking. And then baking it off and kind of, you know, it's sort of like a bread pudding. You could cube bread and toast it, toss it with this leek crema with, you know, a little celery root and leek pureed into it. Fresh thyme is great. Bay leaves are, you know, a great way to season oyster pie as well. Using the oyster liquor kind of as a stock is a good idea to sort of saturate the toasted bread. And then putting some oysters in there, baking it off with a little cream, maybe even a small amount of Parmesan cheese. It's not something I typically make a ton of, but maybe I'll have to try it this year with all these ideas.
And considering Hurricane Florence, and that, you know, after that storm came through, we heard from so many people, stay away from local seafood because there's a level of contamination now that's not healthy, especially shellfish. Is that still true? Are we going for local oysters? Are we going for...
So, there was a lot of, I think there's been a lot of residual concern from Hurricane Florence and all of the bad things that were happening. Oyster season and oysters they're good. Local oysters are great to use now, and oyster season is open, and tests are done on oysters, you know, on a regular basis. And so I think people should be confident that, you know, our waterways are, you know, not in the situation they were in immediately after Florence. And so we work with a lot of great local oyster farmers. Wild oyster season also just opened as well, and so we don't use a lot of wild oysters, but we do use some that are harvested in really small batches that are sort of special. And, you know, there's a lot of movement in those waters out there, and everything's good now.
That's good to hear. The bread that goes into the oyster pie, before we leave this, are we talking about Lydia Clopton's famous Bene Seed Focaccia?
That would be great. I also love, you know, she makes a sourdough from time to time that is very special, and she also has a multigrain seed bread. And these breads are so different than anything you can get because they're all – she really cares about sourcing the ingredients, and the ingredients are – you know, the flowers are coming from North Carolina, as are the seeds and things like that. So they're rustic. They're really comforting breads.
The making of the Bene seed focaccia, which is its own legend around Wilmington now, is a process that takes, what, about 4 hours?
Right.
And what is involved in that process?
It's fairly straightforward. It's flour and water and yeast and salt. And we make the dough in a mixer with a dough hook. We let it rest for a couple hours. And then we'll fold it and a couple times put it on a sheet tray, let it rise with a lot of olive oil, and bake it at a really high temperature. And it sort of just gets fried in the olive oil while it's cooking in the oven. And I think that's what's really special about it.
That is. And that cabbage casserole that we've been talking about in relation to this show all week, we're going to get to that when we come back from this break. Something, Dean, that you discovered people at the Welcome Table really enjoyed.
That's right.
You're listening to Coastline. It's our holiday food show. Dean Neff and Lydia Clopton of Pinpoint and Love Lydia are with us today and answering your food questions. When we come back from the break, we're going to hear from Eric of Wilmington. We'll get to some more listener questions via email. You can ask your own question by calling us on this Wednesday at 910-343-1138 or emailing us today at coastline@whqr.org. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline, I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Today, we're answering your holiday food questions for the first time on Coastline's Holiday Food Show. We have pastry chef Lydia Clopton of Pinpoint Restaurant in downtown Wilmington and also Love Lydia. And we have executive chef and co-owner of Pinpoint, Dean Neff. If you'd like to ask your own question during this live Wednesday discussion, you can call us at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. Eric from Wilmington asks, for Christmas, we're hosting. Good for you, Eric. My wife is gluten sensitive, not intolerant, and her sister has a latex allergy. Are there any good side dishes they can enjoy together? And Dean Neff.
Let's see here. So, you know, I think there are a lot of recipes that, you know, where you can really steer clear of the gluten, and, you know, with doing casseroles and things like that, kind of using that leek crema idea is a great substitution for a bechamel, which does have, you know, can have flour in it. Same. Another thing with gravy, something that can be kind of fun, and is to thicken it with rice or potatoes instead of using a roux. A lot of people use flour, but sometimes you get as long as you don't overdo it, you know. And you, especially with rice, if you use a really nice like Carolina Gold variety, you can kind of cook rice down and then add it into gravy and puree it in a blender, and really break down those starches and thicken it. Without using a traditional roux, and it actually kind of tastes just as good, or maybe even better, you know, depending on how you do it and what sort of rice you use.
The latex allergy. What? Okay, so I'm not the only one who's confused about that. Right on. Joel from Wilmington says, I'm going to try to tackle a 10-pound turducken from Louisiana stuffed with cornbread and sausage on my big green egg. Okay. I was thinking about an apple cider base. Any tips?
That's like a true next level, you know, attempt here. And so, yeah, I think an apple cider based would be really good with that. I think the key with glazes and bastes is to kind of wait until the very end. So I'm trying to think. You have a turducken is turkey, duck, and quail in the center. And so turkey is on the outside. You want to make sure, and if you have any kind of sugar in your glaze, to apply it to the turkey skin late in the process. Otherwise, you can burn the sugars. And so, you know, glazes you need to be really careful about. You know, if you're cooking a bird for 2.5 hours and you glaze it with sugar, the sugar will burn before the bird is done all the way through. So that would be kind of the only advice, and you know, making sure that it's not too sweet or too, you know, acidic, and kind of creating like a lacquer to finish the bird with that's maybe a little thicker and not so thin that you have to rely on it to reduce down to glaze the bird at the end.
So how much time then should that glaze be on the bird?
So, you know, it depends on – so on a Big Green Egg, the great thing about those is that you can cook, you know, at very low temperature. So it kind of all depends on how high of a temperature she's going to cook this bird. And it seems like, you know, one of the tricks with a turducken is that you have to cook a duck – all the way through to get that center quail, it's quail, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Done all of the way, and because you really do want to cook that to about 160 degrees or 65, and so yeah, I think that, you know, getting you're going to have more control over this if you make your lacquer or glaze fairly thick and really finish it maybe for the last 10 minutes. Kind of on high heat on that grill, and just watch it to make sure you're not burning sugars too much.
So let's go back to this cabbage casserole. Now, for those who've never either tasted one or made one, it might not sound like what we would call comfort food. So what's the secret, Dean Neff? Why is this the star of the show for you?
I think cabbage oftentimes is underappreciated, and you know, it takes a little bit of thought. But one of the great things about it is it's super cheap. You buy it in abundance, and it goes a long way. It feeds a lot of people. And one of the tricks to making cabbage taste great is to develop color. And cabbage, and you know, it's one of those vegetables that seems like it would need to be blanched because it seems almost as if it doesn't have a lot of moisture in it. It actually does have a significant amount of water in it, though. And so the way we start this dish is I take it and shave it thinly, and then over low heat, begin to sort of braise it with a little bit of olive oil and butter. If you add a little bit of salt at this point, it'll help release some of that natural water content that's in the cabbage. And so it'll kind of stew, and then as that evaporates, it'll roast, and you'll get color, and it will wilt down. So that's the first key step to this cabbage casserole. You're developing color. You're pulling out the water. Those are some of the things that are not so great about cabbage, the high water content. And then after doing that, we're going to make a really simple gratin. And again, using, you know, a little heavy cream with leeks and celery root. Celery root is also a key ingredient to this. I grate celery root with a box grater and mix it in with the cabbage after the cabbage has been browned. And then we're going to drizzle this leek crema over the top, season it with a little bit of thyme, lots of Parmesan cheese, a bay leaf or two is great in there as well. And then we're going to bake it covered to really cook everything and stew everything, make sure that the celery root is getting cooked all the way through and everything is nice and tender. And then to finish it, you want to take off the top and allow it to bake in the oven at about 325 degrees to get golden brown. Be careful about broiling it. It's better to be a little patient with it. Leave the top off and let those natural liquids sort of reduce out while you're browning the top of it. It is so good. I mean, you've got this, you know, golden brown cheese. You've, you know, roasted the cabbage slowly. You've got leeks. You've got celery root. It's something that is just truly mind-blowing for a lot of people because, you know, they've never had anything quite like it. And it's easy. And back to what Lydia was saying about having, you know, the ability to spend time, this is one of those dishes that you could almost prep up the day before, 2 or 3 days out, and you could have it ready to go and then just heat it in the oven. It's like you want to save yourself a little bit of time the day of to have time to spend with your loved ones.
Cabbage casserole will reheat well.
It does, yeah. It absolutely does. You want to make sure it's hot all the way through, but you could even assemble it and just bake it at, you know, the day of as well if you prefer to do it that way.
You're listening to Coastline. It's our holiday food show. Answering your questions today, Dean Neff, executive chef and co-owner of Pinpoint Restaurant in downtown Wilmington, and Lydia Clopton, pastry chef at Pinpoint and owner of the bakery Love Lydia at 3rd and Greenfield Street in the South Front District. You can ask your own question on this Wednesday by calling us at 910-343-1138 or sending an email to coastline@whqr.org. We're going to get to Alex from Castlehaine in just a second. But first, Lydia, how many breads, different kinds of breads, would be a reasonable option for people at a Thanksgiving dinner with, say, you know, 10 or 12 people?
I think two's probably a good amount. Like maybe have like a gluten-free option like cornbread or something, and then a dinner roll or a nice like crusty bread is always a nice thing to have.
How do you approach cornbread? Do you have a favorite way to do it?
Dean's actually the cornbread master in the family.
Okay. I'll know about that.
he loves making cornbread.
I stopped
making it a long time ago because Dean took over the cornbread.
So for people who don't know this, we're talking to a couple that's not only do they work together, but they worked on opening Pinpoint together and have been engaged for 4 years.
Yeah, last week. 4 years last week.
Yep. Congratulations.
Thanks.
can't imagine, they said before we started the show, being without one another. Is there a date, a target date for a wedding?
3 years ago.
I'm putting you on the spot here. Okay. So cornbread, your favorite approach to that.
So cornbread, I think, you know, people, I kind of grew up eating Jiffy cornbread, which was, you know, it has sugar in it. And so people get very up in arms about sugar and cornbread. And so I've learned to love cornbread without sugar, and have kind of worked on a recipe. I think the key is good buttermilk, great cornmeal, no flour. You use a mixture of baking soda, baking powder, make sure and season it with salt. Also adding a little melted butter, and then typically what I do is I'll preheat an oven with a empty cast iron skillet in it, and then you pull it out, you add in some whole butter. It begins to bubble and coat the bottom of the pan, and then you pour your batter in and bake it just until everything's set up. And it's comforting, and it works as a great side, and it's great because it is gluten-free.
We're talking with Dean Neff and Lydia Clopton, both of Pinpoint and Love Lydia in downtown Wilmington, answering your holiday food questions on this Wednesday. You can call us at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. Alex from Castlehaine, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm a longtime listener, first-time caller.
Wonderful.
I've been to both establishments that these two restaurateurs own, and they put out some really great food. I'm a big fan. Today's question that I have is for Chef Neff. I was wondering if there is a more contemporary approach to a traditional Thanksgiving feast in lieu of something as you know, overdone as turkey. My friends and I like to get together. We do a gourmet take on burgers. Have kind of a less formal gathering. We call it Big Time Burger Time. And I didn't know if Chef Neff had any nuanced approaches to, classic American cuisine when it comes to the holidays that he could recommend. And I'll take my answer off air.
All right. Thanks so much. Good question, Alex.
So, yeah, I think turkey is tricky in a lot of ways. And there have been years where I've kind of sworn off turkey. And I was like, I would prefer to roast a whole salmon or to do, you know, something a little bit different. But I think that you're going to, you know, it depends. I think you should maybe save these other ideas, you know, maybe doing like a whole, like a beef roast or something like that for Christmas. Christmas is right around the corner. I feel like you're going to start a fight with people who demand turkey on Thanksgiving. And so, but having other options, I think, is always a really great way to accommodate people and to show people that you care kind of about, you know, their dietary needs and you care about them and you're putting some thought into what you're serving. So, I think having, whole roasted cauliflower is something that can be kind of treated, as a meat. And, a lot of times people will just boil it and salt it and that's it. But if you were to blanch it and then, you could even brine it as well. You could marinate it. You can grill it. You're showing, vegetarians that there's a great option for them on this holiday too. Something else that's kind of nice is to have, what I like to do is set up a grill early and do things like oysters or cook ribs and have those other kind of sort of different items available for people. And it's fun to set up a grill and, later on you can throw wood in it and hang around, outside in the, by the fire. And so that's kind of a nice way to do it too. So maybe offer some of those other things sort of outside of the main meal.
So you're talking about maybe appetizers and finger food and that sort of thing. When you're having people over and if you're shooting for, a midday or early afternoon meal, how much finger food should you offer? I mean, should food just be available all day? Do you ever worry that people will fill up on the finger food and then not have room for the, the main event?
I think that's always a concern, but it's like you're going to be in a food coma either way, and so it can almost like be a little bit of prep work to get you in there. Also, serving something, serving ribs. We've recently started doing these super like pretty spicy ribs that we lacquer with sorghum and hot sauce, and something like that. I want to serve those this year for Thanksgiving pre-dinner, because I feel like something that's really spicy can actually kind of gear you up for all of the heavy mashed potatoes and turkey and all the
other
things.
It's like the warm-up to the workout.
Exactly.
There you go. Jane says, happy with our turkey from Humble Roots, cooked in parchment, but I'm looking ahead to Christmas at the Tidal Creek Farmers Market. Saw that Red Tail Farm in Burgaw has duckling. How would you recommend we prepare this for our holiday table? Hi, Dean.
So,
yes.
Hey, Jane. So duck is one of those kind of trickier ones. I mean, the exception is Peking duck to this, but I kind of feel like if I were to buy a whole duck, I would take the breasts and I would do something different with the breasts and the legs. And so especially with these farm-raised birds, they're a lot more muscular. They're the way, birds should be because they're typically free-range. They move around and I think by taking the breasts and the legs apart, I would make a really simple cure with salt and sugar. And you kind of do two parts salt, one part sugar. So you're creating a brine. If you had 2 cups of kosher salt, you would do 1 cup of sugar. You can put spices like bay leaves and sage and star anise, black peppercorns, and rub this on the legs for 24 hours. Rinse it off, and then poach them really slowly at like 200 degrees in either duck fat or olive oil. And that's cooking those legs really well done because they are from a free-range bird, I think is a good idea. And then you're left with the breasts that you can take those and you can kind of slowly sear them and crisp the skin up and serve those like medium so that they're still a little rosy pink on the breast.
I was going to try to keep the main dishes and the appetizers and finger food separate, but I don't think we can at this point. Lydia Clopton, common mistakes for a first-timer making a pie crust from scratch. What's a food item that might be better to just buy than put in the effort to make yourself? So I also had a question about this pie crust issue. Can you get away? Should we try to get away with store-bought frozen pie crust, or is that just... that's not a thing.
Personally, I wouldn't, because I love homemade pie crust.
You are the expert. What's the difference? What's the taste difference?
Well, I think it's the butter, really, and the flakiness. You just can't replicate the flakiness with a pie crust that's been in the freezer for who knows how long. But if it seems daunting to you, then definitely go buy a store-bought pie crust and focus your attention on the filling and what you're going to put in it and make that amazing, because people will love it and they're not going to snub their nose at a store-bought pie crust.
That's right.
You made it.
So you can do it. But Caitlin is going to make her first pie and she is determined to make the pie crust.
Okay.
So what are the pitfalls for that she can sidestep with your advice?
Well, there's a couple things. You want to keep everything ice cold. So this is the first step is when you're measuring out all of your ingredients. I like to put everything in the freezer, including the flour, before I make it. And that's going to make it a lot more successful because your kitchen could be hot. Depending on how you're mixing everything, your hands could be hot. Some people like to make it with their hands. I personally like to make it in a food processor to cut the butter up. And adding the water, a lot of times it'll call for a certain amount of water, but you don't always want to use the water that the recipe calls for. You have to, you just want to put in enough water so that the dough just starts to come together. If you squeeze it together, it becomes a dough. If you add too much water, there's not really any going back, and you can overwork the dough. It'll make it a lot harder to roll out and sticky. Some people like to add vodka. I personally don't do that, but it can help you, give you a little bit of a buffer from the danger of overworking the dough and developing too much gluten, which will not result in a tender, flaky crust.
So can you taste the vodka in the pie crust?
No, it evaporates when it cooks.
That's an interesting approach. You're listening to Coastline. Today we're learning about new ways to cook the turkey. We're going to learn about making the humble kale the star of the show in the next segment, and how to make a pie crust. Pastry chef Lydia Clopton of Love Lydia and Pinpoint and Pinpoint's executive chef Dean Neff are with us today, and they're answering your holiday food questions on this Wednesday. One more segment for you to get your question in by calling 910-343-1138. Or emailing us at coastline@whqr.org. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. It's a holiday food exploration today, a troubleshooting operation, fantasy table creation with Pinpoint's co-owner and executive chef, Dean Neff, and pastry chef at Pinpoint, also of the new bakery Love Lydia, Lydia Clopton. It's the first time we've had a bona fide pastry chef on the Holiday Food Show, so don't hold back on those baking questions on this Wednesday. You can call us at 910-343-1138 or email us today at coastline@whqr.org. Lydia, just to finish up the pie crust thing, so you put everything in the freezer to keep everything cold. You're careful with the water. Some people swap out vodka to help with that issue. Any other potential pitfalls there? Or did we kind of cover that?
I think when you're rolling it out, resting the dough a little bit before you put it in your pie pan, it does take a little bit of experience to feel whether it needs to rest or not. But sometimes if you're working the dough too much, it'll start to shrink in on itself and get smaller after you've rolled it out. And that's sort of a signal that you just need to like back off, and maybe you can put it in the fridge covered for like 20 minutes or so to keep it everything cold, because you do want to keep everything cold until you put it in the oven. But once it starts to feel like it's pliable again and it's not shrinking in on itself, then you'll want to put it in the crust and put it in the freezer. Shape it however you want. Like, you don't even have to do a fancy design. Just put it in there and put it in the freezer and freeze it before you put it in the oven. That's going to be another really crucial step.
And this is a real beginner question, but do you bake if it's a two crust pie, crust on the bottom and on the top? Do you bake the bottom first?
I wouldn't normally with a double crust pie for any single crust pie, I always would bake the crust first, which is called blind baking. So you'd fill it with either parchment paper or I like to use aluminum foil and put a weight in there like beans or rice or sugar. Any of those things will work, and you're going to just fill it all the way to the top and put it in the oven and bake it for 325, maybe 40 minutes or so, pull it out, and then you're going to bake the bottom of the crust until it's nice and golden brown. And the beauty of using glass pie dishes is you can kind of lift it up and see if it's baked all the way through, and you don't want it to look translucent at all. You want it to be nice and brown.
Valerie says, this year the turkey I bought didn't come with the neck and giblets. Not a good surprise. I have homemade chicken stock on hand and would have used it for turkey gravy along with those parts. What advice do you have? She since solved it. She went to a butcher and got some turkey and giblets on her own. But if she didn't have those, turkey gravy, how do you do that, Dean Neff?
I think that something that's really helpful to have around before the day of is a really dark poultry stock. And so this could be, you know, made with chicken bones or duck bones or turkey bones. Seems like the best bet is to kind of use chicken bones, though. Roast them. You know, when we talk about brown stock, it's all about whether or not the bones were roasted before the stock was made. And so you would want to really roast the bones. And then simmer this down really slowly and create sort of a stock that you can use for fortifying your gravy. Also, stuffing. Stuffing, you need a really delicious stock. If you're relying on making a stock with the turkey bones, you know, you have to have something else kind of on hand. I'll typically kind of fortify a roasted chicken stock, chicken bones, with a low sodium, either vegetable or chicken stock as well. Cook it down really slowly. The more time you have to cook it, the more you can reduce it, the more concentrated the flavors, and the better that actually will be, especially for your stuffing. I think it's important to have a really good stock for that.
We had a comment on social media today. Our webmaster, Caitlin, reached out and said, what are the most common Thanksgiving blunders? Do you have any turkey disaster stories? Someone says, thinking your extended family will behave themselves. Like pregnancy, I guess. 12 months is enough time for the pain to fade enough for you to try it again. Okay. Thank you for that. Nick is correcting us about turducken. He says, there's no quail in turducken. The N is chicken. Nick, could it also be Cornish game hen, or is this just a game of nesting the birds like Russian nesting dolls? Is it, I mean, does Brunswick stew have to have squirrel? Dean Neff.
I didn't know there was squirrel in Brunswick stew, actually.
Okay. So that's not a thing anymore. Nick's question is, I've been brining my turkey overnight and like the results. I've been considering sticking my polyscience sous vide right in the brine. Any thoughts?
Let's see here. So this is a great direction with turkey, and it's cooking sous vide. You're cooking in a circulated controlled water bath, and so cooking in the brine, I would recommend rinsing the brine off and cooking it in something, you know, putting a little olive oil, minimizing that excess liquid. I feel like you can, brines tend to sort of leach out albumin and proteins from meats. And so it might work, but I think when I pull something out of a brine, I like to kind of pat it dry a little bit and then infuse with fats typically. And so if, you know, we're the sous vide thing, we're going to seal and bag the turkey breast or the whole turkey if you have a very large bag and a very large water bath. But, you know, putting in flavors like fresh thyme, sage, lemon, peppercorns, bay leaves, you know, herbs are a really great thing to add in there. And I think olive oil or whole butter is a really good way to go. And then, of course, once that's cooked, it's been sort of poached and steamed in this bag. And so it's really important to... I think smoked turkey is the best turkey. And so I typically like to have the grill going. And if I am going to sous vide a turkey breast, I'll we'll cook it sous vide, and you cook it all the way through until it's done. It really is the it really keeps all the moisture in, but you really need to develop some color on the outside skin, and that's where the grill comes in. Or you could even broil the skin if you didn't want to smoke it. But I like to go out on the grill and kind of get a little smoke with applewood and try to crisp that skin. But back to the original question, I think taking the discarding the brine and starting with something fresh would be kind of, I think, the best way to do it.
You're listening to Coastline. It's our annual holiday food show with Dean Neff and Lydia Clopton of Pinpoint and the bakery Love Lydia. You just have a few minutes left to ask your own question on this Wednesday by calling us at 910-343-1138 or emailing us today at coastline@whqr.org. Beth from Wilmington, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Happy Thanksgiving, everyone.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Dean and Lydia, this is Beth from the Food Bank. I wanted to call and thank you for everything you do for our community. But my question is for Lydia. So I come from a traditional Italian family, and pies and cakes were not really our thing during the holidays. Cookies are our thing, and cookie trays were a big tradition for Thanksgiving and Christmas. And I wonder if Lydia has a favorite cookie that she likes to bring out during the holiday season. And if you do, what is it?
Ooh, hi, Beth. let's see. I don't think I've ever made a Thanksgiving cookie, but
I think we should start this year.
Yeah,
that's a great idea, Beth. I love
pumpkin.
It.
I think I've made pumpkin cookies before. That would probably be good. It's kind of like a cross between like a cake and a cookie, a real soft cookie, with some chocolate chips in it. That'll be good. For the holidays, like Christmas time, I like speculoos, which is sort of like those Biscoff cookies you get on Delta. They have lots of holiday spices in them. I would look up a recipe for that. They're nice and crunchy. They're my favorite.
Oh, that sounds really good.
Or you could email Lydia.
I can make my way to Love. I can make my way to Love Lydia to try those cookies.
Please Beth, do.
You guys have a great holiday.
Thanks,
season.
Beth. You too.
You too.
Thanks
so
that.
Much.
Bye,
Beth.
Guys.
Bye. Tom from Wilmington says, I want to make thick, custardy hot chocolate after my Thanksgiving meal. How do I do this? Lydia Clopton.
Thick, custardy hot chocolate. I would use maybe some heavy cream in your hot chocolate to make it super rich. Normally, I would probably use whole milk, but if you really wanted to take it up a notch, maybe put some heavy cream in there, melt some chocolate, make a chocolate sauce, and
so you would melt chocolate. You wouldn't use cocoa powder for hot chocolate.
I would do both ways. At the bakery, we make a ganache with we use a really nice 70% chocolate, and we pour some hot water over it. Chop the chocolate up, pour some hot water over it, and then use that as a base and pour hot milk over that and a little bit of vanilla syrup and then incorporate that.
We have a comment from Larry who says, I just wanted to give a big thank you to Pinpoint for providing a lunch meal to the welcome table at Grace United Methodist Church. Always a big hit, he says.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks so much for that, Larry. Austin says, I cook my turkey undressed, usually with a split onion inside. Okay if I add an apple to that. Thanks, and happy turkey. Dean.
Sure, why not? You know, I think that in past years, I think people have decided that stuffing a turkey is not a good idea just because you're having to bring the ingredients to 165 degrees to make sure that there's no risk of salmonella. And so I guess it depends on if you're just using that as sort of a flavor enhancer, but I don't know. I think maybe what might be nice is to roast apples and sort of do them outside of the bird. You might end up, you know, being able to kind of baste them with some of that turkey fat and some of those brown bits as the turkey roasts to kind of incorporate that. I would add them later on. They're going to take a lot less time to cook than the bird. But I think I would go outside of the bird, and then that way you wouldn't have to cook that internal temperature of the apple to 165, and you would end up kind of infusing all of that flavor, but also not risk overcooking your bird. Something I learned last night doing a little turkey research is that the breast thermometer that pops up automatically is it pops up at 180 degrees, which is overcooked. And so a good pointer is to pull that thing out and use your own digital thermometer or a probe thermometer, make sure it's calibrated. And you want to go to, in the breast, you're going for like 160, 161, and it'll carry over cook to another, to 4 degrees to 165. So that's a good way to make sure that you're not overcooking. The pop-up ones will take you well beyond cooked.
Oh, that's good to know. Lindsay says, one, Lydia's pecan flour brownie is life-changing. Thank you, Lindsay.
Thanks, Lindsay.
Two, any tips for making a cheesecake from scratch?
Let's see. I would, when you're making it, I would do it in a KitchenAid mixer or a food processor and make sure to just really follow the directions. And it's always going to say, before going to the next step, to scrape the bowl. And that is really important because the cream cheese is just going to build up a layer on your bowl and it's not going to get incorporated. And once you go to dump everything out, you'll have everything will be a liquid and then there'll just be a cream cheese layer on your bowl. And you do not want that. You want everything to be room temperature. You want to add your eggs one at a time to emulsify.
Okay. Howard says, this year I plan on smoking our turkey. In years past, I always brined the bird before putting it in the oven. Should I brine a bird that's going to be smoked? Dean Neff.
Absolutely. Brining a turkey is pretty crucial just because it is such a, it can be a kind of a dry blank canvas. And so by brining, you're increasing the moisture content, making it juicier. You're also able to infuse flavors into that. And then also resting the bird is a really important part. So after it comes off the heat, depending on if you're doing a hot smoke, which I'm assuming he will be doing a hot smoke, take it off the heat, let it rest for 20 minutes before that allows all of the juices to sort of redistribute into the entire bird. If you cut into it when it's hot, you risk kind of all those juices coming out and the turkey being even drier than it should be.
I want to make sure we get to this way of cooking kale that has opened your eyes. Some of us feel like we've overdosed on hearing about kale and eating kale, but this is new for you. So tell us about it.
So this is just kind of the best way I've ever found to cook kale. And kale has, can have a bad rap a little bit, and it's not so great raw. But with green vegetables, I think oftentimes you really need to think about big pot blanching. And so that is boiling in heavily salted water just briefly to tenderize and then shocking it immediately in ice water. This kind of retains the green color. And with this particular recipe, I think this is a recipe, if you love food, you read cookbooks, and every now and then you'll steal things sometimes from people. There's a chef by the name of Suzanne Goyne, who is a chef out in California, who is wonderful. And I think this is probably a version of something that she has done in one of her cookbooks. But basically, you blanch the kale, and then you slowly poach it in lots of olive oil. We serve this at the restaurant, and what we do is we add shaved garlic and onions. And after blanching and shocking in ice, we squeeze out all of the water. We poach this at about 200 degrees. There should be just a really slow bubble of olive oil. We add in a little chili flake, rosemary, and we cook it for about an hour and a half.
That's this edition of Coastline. I wish we had another hour. Lydia Klopt and Dean Neff, thank you both so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much for having us.
Coastline's technical director is Ken Campbell. Producer is Rachel Keith. Production manager is Caitlin Hanrahan. Caitlin Freund is our webmaster. Coastline is a production of WHQR Public Media. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at WHQR.org. Get the podcast, find it on the HQR app, or just tune in for the rebroadcast of this episode. Sunday afternoon at 2. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.